Don't you wish you had a dollar for every time you heard somebody say the word happy? Would that make you happy? That dollar's on me. We do think a lot about how to become happy and stay in a happy zone. And there are now countries, Bhutan at the top of the list, that provide an index of gross national happiness, while the rest of us are counting things like gross domestic product. Today's guest is versed in both indices. Paul Dolan is the author of the book Happiness by Design, Change What You Do, Not How You Think. Paul Dolan is a professor of behavioral science at the London School of Economics and Political Science and has been a visiting research scholar at Princeton University. He lives in England and advises the National Academy of Sciences on measurement issues in happiness research. Paul Dolan, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello there. Thank you very much for having me on.
So your original training is in economics, is that right?
It is, yes. I have a PhD in economics. That is very true for my sins.
How did you get from the so-called dismal science to happiness studies?
That's a very good question. Serendipitously. Most things that happen to us are random and chance. And so I carved out a successful career in health economics, and I won a prize to buy out some of my teaching time and some money to go off and do what I wanted. And I saw there was an economics of happiness conference on, so I thought that sounds like fun, went to that, and met Danny Kahneman, who many of you will know, author of Thinking Fast and Slow, and kind of got really sort of sucked into thinking about how we might more directly measure the impact of public policies and interventions and the things that we do in our lives, really, on how they make us feel. That seemed to me an obvious next step for me, really.
And Danny Kahneman in the foreword says you're more interested in people's experiences of life than evaluations of life. Can you parse that a bit for us?
Yeah, so let me tell you a story that I've told many times. I'll try and make it sound like this is the first time that I'm ever telling it. it's a story of a friend of mine who worked. She's actually since changed her job, which I think is quite insightful. But she worked for a prestigious media company here in the UK. And we went for dinner, and she spent the whole of the evening complaining about her boss, her commute, her colleagues. Everything about her day-to-day experience was making her miserable. And then without any hint of irony, she said at the end of dinner, "Of course, I love working where I work." And that actually, I think, isn't that odd, actually. Many of us live our lives in the stories that we think about things that should make us happy. So she was working for a great company. Her family and friends were jealous of her working there. How could she not be happy when she thought about being happy there? But actually, day-to-day, moment-to-moment, her experiences told her something quite different. So I'm arguing that we pay much more attention to how things make us feel day-to-day, moment-to-moment, than the stories we tell about whether they ought to or not.
Is it kind of like complaining all through your vacation, but then when you look at the pictures of the vacation, you realize, hey, we really had a lot of fun?
Yeah, well, holidays make people miserable, I think. I'm sure of it most of the time. I think most of the time, well, you know, you kind of go away for a fortnight and you spend all of that time trying to, you know, have those moments where the whole family come together as one. But the rest of the time, they all want to go in different directions and go and do different things. And it's that one moment that kind of crystallizes in our memory of the experience. And we come back and we say, didn't we have a fantastic time? And it's true, you did have a fantastic time when you think about that one fantastic moment. But the rest of the time was probably anything but happy-making.
All right, that might have been a bad example. One of the things that you do point out early in the book is that it sounds like happiness and behavior are often researched by different people in different places. Why is that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. By the way, it's very nice to have a conversation about some of the serious science stuff. I've been having quite a few conversations here about how individuals can make themselves happy in more of a trivial way, I think, sometimes. So I think it's interesting. I think partly because the survey methods or the actual methods that we use differ. So when we're looking at happiness research, we're typically looking at survey data. So we're asking people questions about how happy they feel. And at the moment, that's about the best way that we can find out how someone feels is to ask them. So you've got a group of researchers who are used to looking at big data sets, looking at lots of observations on many people over many years. And in contrast, I think understanding and changing behavior is often done in lab experiments and sometimes in the field where we take relatively small samples of people, intervene on them in some way or other, and see what happens to them when we intervene. So I think it's partly because the methods that we use differ. But it's interesting to me, it's really odd to me, as you will see in the book, that we kind of are trying to think about understanding and changing behavior without inquiring into whether those changes actually make people feel better off or not.
So in one sense, we're really sort of working blind. It's like, well, we'll change this, but we don't. It sounds like we don't really have a great reason for why.
Well, I think a lot of policymakers think they know why, right? I mean, I think, you know, a lot of public policy in health, in education, in housing is about knowing what's good for people. And so I think there's a supposition that we don't even need to inquire into whether this is actually working or not or making people feel better because we kind of know. Whereas, of course, I think much of the data and evidence tells us now that some of those things that policymakers might assume make people better off, and partly because of the stories that they tell, right? To come back to the earlier piece, the stories that they tell about the things that they think should make people happy might not be quite consistent with the things that actually do in people's experiences. So I think probably policymakers are starting to wake up to that now. They're starting to realize that actually many of the things that they think people need might not always cohere with the things that make people feel better.
Ah, needs and the happiness thing don't necessarily coalesce. We'll talk much more with Paul Dolan when we come back from a break. His book is Happiness by Design, Change What You Do, Not How You Think. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Dolan and your comments and questions via phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Paul Dolan, Professor of Behavioral Science at the London School of Economics and Political Science, the author of the book Happiness by Design, Change What You Do, Not How You Think. That is the subject of our hour on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join us here, 800-838-3760. Anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760, email address jx@jeffnet.org. Paul, explain the little warm-up you put in the front of the book, if you would.
Sorry, was that it?
That was you, yeah. So would you explain, there's a little warm-up right in the front of the book.
Yeah, there is. It's kind of hope that it would engage the reader a bit, I think. You know, rather than just sort of passively receiving my words of wisdom, they can engage more fully in them. Don't laugh, I'm being serious. I think, but it's partly also to think by the time they get, it's just kind of interesting to see, by the time they get to the end of the book, do they think differently about the things that they think would make them happy? And I'm not trying to prescribe anything. I think that's really quite important, by the way. I think lots of happiness books you read, they kind of tell you what to do. And I think there's some comfort in that. I think people like being told what to do. Kind of, you know, makes life a bit easier for them. But I try to give people a framework and allow them to work out for themselves what things make them happy.
I notice that this is not a book of tips, you know, make sure that you paint your bedroom wall pink or anything like that. It's really not even close to that.
No, good. Well, I'm glad you think that. It's kind of hopefully the self-help book to end all self-help books. So people can actually work out for themselves how best to, you know, design environments or decide about what things to do differently and kind of work it out for themselves, but with a coherent framework sitting behind it.
Your own story, your own personal story in this book is important because it helps us understand the approach that you recommend. And you talk about your lifelong stammer, and ultimately there was a big change in your approach to it. What was the change?
Yeah, so you're going to get me stammering now. Now I haven't stammered once during the course of this interview, so that's, yeah, so obviously, thank you very much for that. I think it's about attention. I mean, when you stammer, if you stammer, you pay a lot of attention to your fluency, because that's obviously how your stammer So that's obviously how your stammer manifests itself, is through fluency. And so you pay attention to how fluent you are, and you think you're speaking well when you speak fluently and not so well when you don't. But actually, of course, as we all know, really, that speaking is about being able to communicate effectively with people. And once I started paying attention to that, are people actually understanding what I'm saying? Am I able to get over what I want to say in a way that they can understand? And actually then whether there's the odd stammer in there here and there doesn't really make much difference. And once I started paying less attention to the stammer, I think this is the really important bit, I think, it becomes less important to me. I soon realized it didn't actually matter very much to other people because they could understand what I was saying. And then I stammer less.
So is the lesson for the rest of us then that it's not so important what happens, but what we think about what happens?
Well, I think the lesson there, so it's about, what I think the important lesson is, and it's why the subtitle of the book is Change What You Do, Not How You Think, is that I couldn't think myself stammer-free, if you like. I couldn't kind of, you know, work harder at it, put more effort into it. I suppose I could do that, and, you know, that might work to some extent, but it's not natural. It's not kind of how we want to live our lives, paying constant attention to whether I'm going to stammer on the next word, whether this is fluent or not, but rather to pay attention instead to something more important, that is the effectiveness of the degree to which I can communicate. And then the stammer then becomes sort of in the background. So I think it's about learning what to pay attention to, and obviously that's a key theme of the book, is what we pay attention to. So I think it's about, rather than thinking differently, it's a reorientation of how we attend to things. And actually, critically in that, the change what you do, not how you think, is putting ourselves in environments that make us behave differently or feel differently. So, you know, one of the things for me, it was to put myself in situations that I would otherwise find very fearful and scary, to actually realize that most things actually never really turn out as bad as you think they would anyway. And the worst that can happen is that, well, I stammer a bit, and, you know, no one dies. And so, you know, you kind of quickly learn actually doing these things. It's an action-oriented approach, really, doing these things. You know, the feedback from them is that the things aren't actually that bad. And if I stammer a bit here and there, well, it's not the end of the world.
Paul Dolan, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Happiness by Design, Change What You Do, Not How You Think. Definitions of happiness. The book, I should point out, is in two parts, Developing Happiness, Part 1, Delivering Happiness, Part 2. And you do offer a definition of happiness here. Is one of the issues that we face, though, that so many people define happiness somewhat differently?
Yeah, I think they do it wrong, don't they? So, first of all, I think it's really important to distinguish between the stories that people tell and the experiences that they have. And I think it just makes so much more sense to me to think about happiness as a flow of experiences over time, and not as little snapshot moments when we reflect upon our lives. So that's the first critical distinction, to live in experiences, because that's what we are. We are our experiences. And then secondly, to have a richer conception of experience than has otherwise been put forward, I might argue. So it's to think about experiences not just of you know, things that we find pleasurable and painful, and, you know, the joy and the anger and the worry and the stress, of those adjectives that are typically used for feelings, but also a separate important category of feelings, which are the degree to which things that we do feel purposeful, worthwhile, meaningful, fulfilling. And in contrast, futile, pointless, and purposelessness. and then I argue, therefore, that happy lives are ones that contain the right balance for them. And I'm not going to say that what this ought to be for each individual, because that clearly differs for each of us. But that has the right balance for you of things that you find pleasurable on the one hand and things that you find purposeful on the other.
All right, so experiences of pleasure and purpose. And coming back to the anecdote about the friend of yours who talked about how miserable she was, and then she really loves working for the company. So was she feeling a lot more purpose than pleasure? Is that one of the things we can draw from that?
I don't think so. I think that what she was feeling was... It's unclear from her description of how she was feeling whether it was neither pleasurable nor purposeful, but I got the sense that her work had neither, that she didn't feel like it was either fun or fulfilling. The distinction in that story is between those experiences, be they painful or pointless, and the story of the job that she had, which was, as I say, it's a really nice narrative, and we do this a lot of time in the jobs that we're in. We tell a story about how this is a great company, how it has a great set of values, how it's a great place to work, it has status, how our friends and our family are jealous of us working there, all the things that make a very good story about the job, but that sit in sharp contrast to the day-to-day experiences of it. We do it also with the kind, with the people that we hang out with, the people that we choose as partners, right? We'll tell a story about this being the ideal boyfriend or the ideal girlfriend or husband, wife, because they satisfy a set of characteristics. You know, they are what we think ought to make us happy, and actually, day-to-day, they might make us pretty miserable.
Which has been identified, I think, by a few other researchers that we keep putting out these lists. It's like, well, here's my definition of the perfect blank.
Yeah.
And the person matches those things, and still you're not particularly happy with them.
Yeah, I think as soon as anyone started doing that, I wouldn't want to be their friend. No, I would try to get them to read Happiness by Design and change their mind. Because, you know, we all know, you know as well, don't you, that it's just nonsense when anyone says, she's not my type or he's not my type or whatever. No one really has a type. The type is, Do these people that I'm with make me feel good, pleasure or purpose when I'm hanging out with them? That's the type, and there's lots of different types of people that satisfy those experiences.
Paul Dolan, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, British researcher at the London School of Economics and Political Science. He's a professor there of behavioral science. His book is Happiness by Design, Change What You Do, Not How You Think. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the steps to go through. And again, it is not necessarily a book of how-to tips like, you know, change the tires on your car or brush your hair a different way. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking about finding experiences of pleasure and purpose in life. And just to underscore what you said earlier, it's not a consistent thing person to person. Some people need more pleasure. Some people need more purpose.
Yeah, I think so. There'll be some people that are more naturally pleasure-seeking, others more purpose-driven. I think I can make the claim that if you're extremely one or the other, you know, that is, you have lots of pleasure and hardly any purpose or vice versa, that you would probably be happier if you just gave up a tiny amount of the thing that you have a lot of for a little bit more of the thing that you don't have much of. So, you know, if you had lots of purpose, like you work at the LSE and you spend all your time writing academic papers and teaching students these learned things, you should probably go out and have some fun once in a while.
I'm struck by the ability of human beings, because it seems like it doesn't often get raised this way, but we do have the ability to delay pleasure when we think we'll get it long term. So increasing purpose while decreasing pleasure, and you bring it up in the context of people getting divorces, where there's a lot of pain in the short term, but ultimately good in the long term, or giving up smoking, which is not very comfortable in the short term, but good for you in the long term.
Yeah, so can I say a couple of things about that? So first of all, with the divorce thing, it's about attention again. So when you separate from someone, there's lots of attention paid to the uncertainty. You know, will we get back together again or not? And that kind of attention is very misery-making, actually. That kind of uncertainty that draws attention to itself makes people miserable. When you get divorced, there's like kind of finality, and it's over, and now your psychological immune system can kick in and start to make sense of what's happened. So they weren't the right person for me. I'll find someone better. And all of which is actually true, by the way, because most of us do go on to find someone better than the person that we were with before. So that's a kind of explanation. And the way that adaptation processes work is that we need some explanation for why things have happened. And when you've got that uncertainty, you can't have that explanation. So that's why we observe that. But when it comes to the delayed gratification, I think it's interesting that's what people would typically talk about when they're talking about pleasure now versus pleasure tomorrow. So if I can kind of give up a little bit of pleasure now, I can have more of it later. When you add purpose into the set of experiences, I think that those trade-offs become, well, less and less important, less often, less meaningful, because if something might not feel pleasurable now but does feel purposeful, then it makes you happy and it's worth you doing it, quite aside from what the future benefits might be. But if something that you're doing now you find neither pleasurable nor purposeful, well, you better be damn sure that the benefit you're going to get tomorrow is worth the cost that you're paying now. Because if it's not, then it wasn't worth it because you're just making yourself miserable. Because happiness isn't like money. You can't transfer it around between periods. You can't say, I'll have, you know, 5 units of happiness now in order to have 6 later. You're only getting the 5 units now. So if you're not going to be, if you're not 100% certain that that delay is going to be worth it, then you shouldn't do it. Because one of the lines, that I like in the book, of course, I like every line, but there's some that I like more than others, is that lost happiness is lost forever. Which means that, you know, once you don't have happiness, you don't have it. You know, you can't kind of claim it back later.
You know, there's so many measures of happiness that you bring up in the book, including the DRM, the Day Reconstruction Method. How does that work?
Yeah, well, that's Kahneman's innovation. And the idea is to take what we would get from experience sampling, which is basically to ask people how happy they're feeling at certain moments when they get asked, and to add in duration, add in how long those experiences and those activities last. So basically, you kind of carve up yesterday into a series of episodes, like in a film, and then you say what you were doing, who you were with, and how you felt during each of those episodes. And so that's the kind of experience-based data that I think are more useful for understanding our own happiness, and importantly, allowing us to think about how we use the scarcest resource of all. That's our time. You and I are now half an hour closer to death than when we first started talking.
And, I feel richer for it.
We're not going to get that time back. I know. Well, it has been fun and it has been fulfilling, right? But we're not going to get that half an hour back. So I think it's incumbent on us that we, you know, each of us, all of us, think about ways in which we can use our time differently, or, you know, kind of at the margin, just reallocate bits of it in ways that move us out of things that we don't find pleasurable nor do we find purposeful, into things that give us at least one of those two things.
Paul Dolan, again, our guest on The Exchange. His book is Happiness by Design, Change What You Do, Not How You Think. So on the Day Reconstruction Method, it looks like working we consider purposeful but not pleasurable. We consider TV pleasurable but not purposeful.
Yeah.
I mean, I imagine there are a bunch of activities that can anything really accomplish both?
I think volunteering comes close. It's very purposeful. But it also, perhaps surprisingly, I guess, also feels quite pleasurable too. I think helping others is a really good thing to do for other people and also for yourself.
Which then raises the other question, as you point out. It seems like the feelings about what we were doing change a bit when there are other people doing it with us.
They do. There are some activities that I think we find... we generally find most things more pleasurable and more purposeful when we're with other people, but there are some interesting differences. I seem to recall, and it's in the book, so you don't want to give it all away, do you? You don't have to tease people. And actually, if I say what follows is actually wrong, then they can point it out to me once they bought the book. But I think when people do sports alone, I think they find that more purposeful than when they do that with other people. I think it probably means that other people get in the way of them being able to achieve their goals. But for most things, most of the time, we get more pleasure and more purpose when other people are with us. Most of us like being around other people. Even people that would say they are or actually are introverts like being around other people. They just like choosing who those other people are.
Are there any stark differences, Paul, between genders or age groups? I mean, does the curves change a bit depending on who you're talking to?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There are some. This is actually where you get some big differences, or at least some important differences between evaluations and experiences. With age, in all evaluation data, where we ask people global questions like, you know, overall, how satisfied are you these days, you get a very clear U-shaped age effect. That is, people start off happy in their 20s and 30s. They get less happy as they go through their 40s and into their early 50s, and then their happiness starts to go up again. In the experience data, it's a little bit messier. Some measures go up, some go down, some stay flat. The thing that's really interesting, though, is the experiences of purpose, which are very low in people under the age of about 25, and then they start to rise again after that. So, you know, basically, teenagers and early 20s is not a time for experiencing purpose.
But certainly experimenting with pleasure, it seems like.
Experimenting with pleasure, did you say, or experiencing pleasure? Both, actually, probably. The sort of pleasure curve doesn't really change very much by age. I think what happens is that we kind of get different types of pleasure, right? So I think you know, when you're younger, you're more interested in excitement and, you know, more interested in feeling excitement. As you get older, you're more interested in feeling calm and content. So I think that's kind of what happens, is that the things that that kind of emotion that we capture under that broad heading changes slightly.
Welcome back and talk more with Paul Dolan about his book, Happiness by Design, Change What You Do, Not How You Think. And again, it's an examination of the things we pay attention to really in our own lives, and finding pleasure and purpose, finding the balance between the pleasure and purpose and the pleasure-purpose principle, as he puts it, PPP. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Dolan, and your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Paul Dolan, professor of behavioral sciences at the London School of Economics and Political Science. He lives in England and advises the National Academy of Sciences on measurement issues in happiness research, hence his new book, Happiness by Design, Change What You Do, Not How You Think. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about how to make the pursuit of happiness a bit more intentional. Phone number here, 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The term I just used was intentional, but the fact is it is attention that is also apparently a prime component of making a meaningful effort at happiness, Paul, it sounds like.
Yeah, so I think if you kind of think about the two, what I think about the two contributions of the book from a scientific point of view, I suppose, before they then get into the usefulness of them, is the pleasure-purpose principle, which we've just spent some time talking about. And the second is that we are what we attend to. That's actually not a new insight. I mean, that's been around for a very, very long time. I think where the new insight comes from is that a lot of what we attend to is not just consciously determined, you know, like when I'm paying attention to you now, speaking to you, but is influenced significantly by contextual and situational factors. We pay attention to things in automatic ways, in ways that we're unaware of, driven by environment. So, you know, you're more likely to, you know, clean up after yourself in a canteen, or to wash your hands in a hospital if citrus lemon smell is being pumped through the atmosphere. Why? Well, we think because you're paying attention to the citrus lemon smell, which automatically is cueing you to do something that's associated with that. So clean your hands, tidy up your table. And you would be unaware that that prime in the environment is cueing you to act in that way. So I think attention is critical, both in terms of how we consciously use it and pay attention. That's quite important, right? We pay attention. That means that we are paying by not being able to pay attention to something else. The fact that I'm speaking to you now means that I'm not speaking to someone else about something else. But we also unconsciously allocate it by the influences that sometimes very small and subtle effects in our local situation have on us.
You write that our brains are lazy and want to conserve attentional energy, just as a matter of not burning too many calories or something?
I think it is exactly that. It's because we've typically had a caloric deficit, but also because I think the brain wants to conserve attentional energy. It's quite efficient to do that, right? You're making 2,000 to 10,000 decisions every day. If you had to effortfully think about each and every one of those, your head would explode. So what your brain tries to do is to create habit loops to make your life easy. So the fact that you now lock your house when you go out of it or turn your oven off after you take a meal out means that you do those things in an automatic way. And when you think about whether you've done them or not, you don't actually know whether you have or not because they're not in your conscious mind. And so what you want to do is a very efficient thing for the brain to do is to kind of conserve energy and to create these habit loops. So to take something that's conscious and effortful and make it automatic and effortless.
And when those cross over, I notice we can get some problems. I don't know if you've seen the studies of the American baseball players, for example, who realized they didn't remember how to throw from second base to first.
I think I understand what that means. That's some sport that goes on for hours and it finishes like 1-0 or something, isn't it? It happened in the seventh inning, I think, or ninth inning, or whatever.
Ninth, yes.
I did go to a game. It was a seventh inning stretch. That's it. That's what, yes, I had to do, to all stand up with everyone in the land of the free and stretch. I was completely lost there. Yeah, so that's a really nice example, sports stars, is you want to take something that's system two, effortful, and make it system one, effortless. So you'll practice your shots, you'll practice the baseball pitch over and over and over again, consciously, until in the end it becomes a habit. And then you don't think about it. You know, the pitcher is throwing, you know, effort. It's just doing it. It's, you know, what it does. But then the moment he starts thinking about it again is when the arm goes, when you get the jips, you basically start to choke, because you're taking something that is a very efficient automatic processes and then making it effortful and hard again.
So is the trick then, in happiness in particular, to make sure that we are paying attention to the things that do give us pleasure or purpose, and to just sort of let the rest slide?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's a very simple, I sometimes feel like you have to say sorry for some of these insights, because it's like bloody obvious, but it's obvious but overlooked. That's the really critical point, obvious but overlooked. I think we all know that if we pay attention to the things that make us happy, we're going to be happier. Well, then why don't we spend more time doing it? Why aren't we spending more time listening to music, being with people that we like being with, going outdoors, having new experiences, helping other people? All these things that, when we pay attention to, make us feel better. And part of the reason is, I think there's two parts to this answer. One is feedback. One is that we don't actually remember, until we really think about it, whether these things actually do make us happy. So we need to get the feedback that all of those things that I just outlined and more besides make us feel good. And other things that we do make us feel bad. So we need that feedback. And that's where we talked about the DRM earlier. I think that's where those insights are quite helpful. They can help you record, you know, what things are making you happy and when and how, and also whom. But secondly, the simple behavioral science lesson, and this is the really basic insight, is if you want to do something, make it easy. And I don't think we make it easy for ourselves to do any of those things. We're charging around thinking that we've all got busy lives, rushing about everywhere, and not taking the 15 minutes, 20 minutes a day to listen to some music, spend some time with people we like, go outside, help other people, that would make us happier. Not just happier that day, but the next day and the day after that. So in the end, we're just doing it automatically. And that's why I think we need to just think about making it easy for ourselves.
Beyond the more specific cataloging, like the DRM, the day reconstruction method, are people who keep diaries somewhat happier people just because they've been able to keep track of the things that happened in that day?
I don't know. Do we know that? I don't know if there's been any randomized trials that have looked at diary keeping versus not diary keeping. I think it helps. Where there are data is where people have experienced trauma. And what you want to do is then very light touch interventions, not go in, you know, boots, you know, stomping in, offering people trauma counseling, because that just embeds that emotion that they're feeling at that time in how they feel subsequently. What they need to do is just like write diaries and kind of light touch interventions now and then, write down how they're feeling. And that seems to work very, very well. I don't know in non-clinical populations whether we have a scientific basis in order for me to answer that question properly.
All right. So much of happiness, too, Paul, seems based on prior expectations. And as you point out in the example in the book of Olympic medal winners, it seems like the bronze medal winner is often happier than the silver medal winner.
Yeah. I mean, what otherwise might have been is really quite significant sometimes in how we feel. On the podium, at least, right? This is where we're actually doing a study that's looking at the longer-term effects if we can. But on the podium, at least, when you get a silver medal, you're looking up at that bloke, woman, I nearly swore then, who's got gold. And it makes you miserable, especially when they won that 100 metres by 1/100th of a second. But when you get the bronze, you're stepping up onto the podium. And you could have been fourth and nowhere near the podium. So it's clear in that example, at that moment, that you probably are happier with a bronze than a silver. The question is whether over time you would be happier with a bronze and a silver. Because over time, you might just forget the context within which that happened and stepping up on the podium and actually think it's a silver medal, I came second, which could be better than it's a bronze, I came third. So I don't think we know over the long term, but we certainly know in the short term and can have very good reasons to explain why bronze is better than silver.
We're talking to Paul Dolan about his book Happiness by Design on the Jefferson Exchange. There's a chart in here of happiness by occupation. In which the hairdresser seemed to be up on top of the list and the banker's way down on the bottom. Was there stuff that you...
Go ahead. No, I said no. That makes me very happy.
Right, especially in today's world after the Great Recession.
At least one of them's doing a job that adds value.
So, was there any breakdown of like whether the jobs involved more mental work than physical work, more physical work than mental work, anything like that? Is there any consistency to it? I guess is what I'm asking.
Yeah. So there are things that you can write in a book that you might not get away with in an academic peer-reviewed journal. They are correlations, so we don't really know. You know, happier people could start out as hairdressers, and less happy people start out as bankers. Or indeed, actually, the most happy bankers leave banking, and the least happy hairdressers leave hairdressing. So we don't know the causation there. What I do think, though, is something that we can say is that there are attributes of hairdressing that lend themselves to being happy. You have a social interaction, generally with someone that wants to be there with you. You generally do, you make them look better. They like that, you like that. You can see the fruits of your labor. The only thing that's missing is the pay, which doesn't draw attention to itself in the experience of your work anyway. In banking, in contrast, there's a whole different set of attributes there. It's not to say I don't think that banking could potentially make people less happy than hairdressing. It's how can we think about the attributes of jobs that make them happy and think about how those attributes could be built into jobs that make people least happy.
All right, I've been spending all my time in part one of the book. I do want to get a little time into part two, delivering happiness. And one of the things you talk about here is make happiness salient. What does that mean?
Remind yourself of it. It's the feedback, I think. It's an interesting one, that. Like most things in life, you want a balance. You don't want to be spending all your time constantly monitoring whether you're happy or not, because that would make you miserable. In fact, you don't probably even want to be paying attention to happiness that much, that often anyway. What you want to do is first of all, establish what things make you happy. You know, what activities, listening to music, going outdoors and those things. And then design your environments in ways that make it easier for you to do those things without then ever having to monitor happiness at all, because you're safe in the knowledge that doing those things makes you feel good anyway. So it's a little bit of monitoring, feedback to begin with, make it salient, make it something that you can understand, make it something that you pay attention to. Design your environment, organize your life in ways that are kind of consistent with that feedback, and then just let yourself run wild.
So set up a framework, in essence, of the things that make you happy, but then don't monitor yourself to the point where you're making yourself unhappy because you're trying to measure happiness.
Exactly. And don't make yourself unhappy because you're not doing what it is that you keep intending to do. You know, I'm going to go to the gym tomorrow. All right, I'll go tomorrow then. I won't. I'll go today because it's cold. All right, I'll go tomorrow then. No, I can't really be bothered to go today. I'll go tomorrow. And then just keep beating yourself up about not doing what you intend to do. If it actually would make you happier to go to the gym, leave your shoes by the bed so you put them on when you get out. And find someone to go with. Find some time in your day where you can take some time either before or after work or during to go to the gym or to exercise, however you want to do it. Have a screensaver that has you exercising on it. You know, do these things that prompt you and remind you and just make it easier for you to do those things rather than keep telling yourself how you're going to change.
When we're trying to find the balance between pleasure and purpose, I mean, are we going to come up with any actual numbers here, or is it just a matter of like, okay, well, I like this, this, and this, and I don't like this, this, and this, so I'll do more of this and less of that?
Yeah, you can write my second book for me if you want. That's actually what's got to go in that. I think the kind of quantification and the exchange rate between pleasure and purpose is what comes next. But, for the moment, I think I wanted to be making a case that there are these two sets of feelings associated with different experiences. And they just feel different. You know, things that, and I'm sure you know this too, right? Things that you do that just at the moment in the experience feel like they're just fun. And other things that don't feel like they're fun but do feel like they're worthwhile. And I'm just trying to get people to kind of reflect on their balance of those things and how they can reorientate themselves, nudge themselves, make it easier for themselves to do the things that will make them happier, probably by doing more of the things that they have least of, whether that be pleasure or purpose, and maybe a little bit less of the other.
But, you know, the balances will be different, obviously, from individual to individual. So it sounds like your next book could actually be about relationships and how to square this up because, you know, your partner may want to have more meaningful experiences and less pleasurable ones than you do, or fewer, I mean.
Yeah, I guess. It'd be an interesting, you could do, wouldn't that be a nice thing to put on a dating site? You know, are you more of a pleasure machine or a purpose engine? And then select your partner based upon... based upon whether they're... Well, it's not obvious what you do, is it, really? Not obvious whether you choose someone that's more like you or someone that's different. As you might want someone that's different, right? I talk about my two friends in the book, the two extremes, you know, Mick, who parties all the time, and then the friend Lisa, who works all the time and has a lot of purpose in her life. If they were together as a couple, they'd either last 5 minutes because they'd hate each other and kill each other, or they'd actually help each other and bring some balance. She would do some more of the things that he does, and he would do more of the things that she does. So I think maybe if you're an extreme of one or the other, you probably want to find the other extreme to balance each other out.
We started by talking about Bhutan and the Gross National Happiness Index. Is England moving towards something like that, do you think? The UK?
Well, mate, listen. We're at the forefront of that. Don't you start getting Bhutan in there. This is we're at the leading edge. UK's right at the forefront. We're actually monitoring national well-being using four headline indicators that broadly capture evaluations and pleasure and purpose. There's some music there. Are you still there?
Yeah, we're still. Go ahead.
Okay, and we've been doing that now for the last 4 years, where we're taking big, large general population samples and asking them those four headline questions, and using it to monitor national well-being alongside other measures that we could otherwise use, as mentioned yourself, like measures of economic activity, GDP, and so on.
Okay, didn't mean to insult you on behalf of Bhutan, but Paul Dolan has been a
hard to insult me. Actually, I'm never, and I absolutely wasn't then either.
All right, thanks so much for joining us today. Very good to have you.